The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 480 for Sunday, December 22nd, 2013.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, cool stuff found, and holiday cheer. We turn that around. We answer your questions. We share your tips. We share tips of our own. We share cool stuff found, and we share holiday cheer. Here from Durham, New Hampshire, where it was snowy, then rainy, and now is getting icy while we're recording the show for you. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, where it's about 60 degrees today, Dave.
Is it really? Wow.
Not a record high, but I think it approached a record high. So I'm like,
wow.
I feel bad for the critters because I think they are all confused. But anyways, yes, in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Well, happy
Fairfield, Connecticut. John F. Braun.
Happy first day that gets slightly longer because that's what today is, right?
Well, the equinox thing, right?
So solstice.
Winter solstice, I'm sorry.
Equinoxes are in the fall and the spring. That's right. So the days start getting longer. That's good.
Very unexpected, though. I mean, I saw people strolling about.
The solstice was very expected. It happens almost like clockwork.
Well, I'm talking the 60
I know.
People running around in their shorts and stuff. I saw some people in shorts today. I was like, not something I've often seen. But yeah, enough about the weather. What's happening?
So if you were to visit squarespace.com/MGG, you would be visiting our first sponsor for this show. And that is obviously Squarespace. If you need or even want to put up a website, this is one of the simplest ways I've ever seen to do it. And I've been creating websites for a long time and you can still do this today. You can make it a really difficult process. Right. You know, hand coding HTML, FTPing files are even, you know, potentially worse, although I'm not sure if it's worse, SSHing into a computer and editing files with something like VI. Right. I mean, you could do that and you could put up a killer website that way, or you could visit squarespace.com/MGG and start building your website graphically right there on the web. And when you want to, say, drag a picture in, you just grab a picture off your desktop and drag it into the template that's already there, and you can customize these templates. They have really beautiful templates, and every one of them is, optimized for like full desktop screens all the way down to iPhone screens and everywhere in between. They have, designs that react to the changing screen sizes and different screens and make your content look really good everywhere. And I have firsthand experience with this. I put my DaveTheNerd.com blog is a Squarespace blog, and I use it constantly. I have used Squarespace for an e-commerce site that we put together quickly. I mean, I did this in an hour for the band. One of the bands I play in, we did a show in the fall and we sold tickets online, and it worked. It just worked great. They partnered with Stripe, a payment engine, and the whole process to building the website, getting integrated with Stripe, all of that was like an hour. I mean, it really was. It was not 2 hours. I'm not exaggerating at all. It might have been 67 minutes, but that's about it. It really, and the stuff just looks good. It's easy to use. Their backend is simple. The best part is you visit squarespace.com/MGG, and that way they know we sent you, and you start building your website. Then once you've got things going, that's when they ask you for your name and you create a login. And then you've got 2 weeks from that point to muck about with things. And once you're ready to buy, then you can use coupon code. And it's the 12th month of the year. And these guys use different coupon codes than our other sponsors. So I want to make that clear. You use MGG12 because it's MGG12. And that way they know that you heard this spot and you get 10% off with that coupon code. So not only does it let them know that you heard it here, but you get 10% off whatever you buy at that point. So check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG. Like I said, I use it and I can't imagine something simpler than that. So check it out, and we'd appreciate it. And I know they'd appreciate it too. And I think the best part is I think you'll appreciate it. That's the most important thing. All right. Robert had a question, and Robert says, he was trying to run, a new version of Handbrake on his Mac. And he said, but Handbrake doesn't work in Mavericks. And it was part of an email exchange. And I said, what are you talking about? I run Handbrake in Mavericks all the time. And he sent me a screenshot that said Handbrake.app can't be opened because it is from an unidentified developer. And then it goes on to tell where Handbrake came from and all of that good stuff. And the only option you have there is OK. So in that sense, you're right. Handbrake won't run.
That's user hostile.
It is user hostile. That's right. Well, but it's part of the gatekeeper function, which came in Mountain Lion, and obviously still there in Mavericks. And the point of it is actually to be friendly to the user, or to keep the user safe from running apps that are from developers that have not identified themselves and registered themselves with Apple. Doesn't mean that they have to sell the app through the Mac App Store. Just means that Apple, by default, your machine will not run apps from developers that have not got a certificate from Apple that allows Apple to know who they are.
Right. It's not signed, I think.
It's not signed.
What it's telling you, not signed, so you may want to question where it came from, because I guess signing is both the developer and Apple saying this is something that you can trust, right?
Well, yeah, more so it's Apple says we know who this developer is. They have proved their identity to us. And there's some benefits there. But there's a difference between Apple saying this is an app from a developer that we know who they are, and this is an app from a developer we don't know who they are, and Apple saying you can't run this app. And that's what happens by default when you try to do something like this. Thankfully, though Apple doesn't make it obvious to you, the user, there is a way around it. The easy way, the one-time exception way, is to simply right-click on the app and choose open. I know that doesn't seem any different, but it will bring up a different dialogue. It will still tell you this is from an unsigned or unidentified developer, but you can choose to run it. And once you choose to run any single app, that same app will always then run, even if you just double click or put it in your dock or whatever. Different apps will not. If you want to universally change this, you go into System Preferences, you go to Security and Privacy, and in the General tab, which is the first one that comes up, there's an option that says Allow Apps Downloaded From, and you have three options. And if you choose anywhere, then basically that turns Gatekeeper off in that sense. And won't bother you at all. I leave mine on the middle setting, which is Mac App Store and other identified developers. And then when I get something like Handbrake, I just, you know, and it warns me, I say, oh, no, that's good. It is a nice safety catch that you're running something that Apple hasn't had a hand in verifying. But, you know, I just right click on it and I kind of move past it. So it is good to know that right click and move past it trick. So that's why we share that with you.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good because the Apple is counting that if you know the secret handshake, which we just told you, which is the right click, you can get past this. But I'm with you, Dave. I have the same setup because I'm uncomfortable allowing everything to run.
Yeah. Without having, I like the secret handshake. It makes it so that I am intentionally running these things that may or may not want to run on my system.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think to anybody, I mean, if you want to live dangerously,
sure,
you can totally disable Gatekeeper, but yeah, I don't think either of us recommend that.
Right. Right. No, I don't. Right. I don't. All right. Another interesting thing came up that has come up before, but I don't think we've discussed it on the show, but we've heard about it from several listeners, in our email conversations with you. This one was listener Gray saying that he was at the terminal and needed to use the sudo command, sudo, which, as we've discussed, allows you to run whatever command you type after that as a fully privileged root user or administrator. And when you do that, the system puts up a password dialog and you type in your password, but you don't see any of your characters reflected back at you. So it's a blind thing, and that's done for security reasons, and it's normal. It's fine. He was saying that he was trying to type his password. It kept telling him that it was wrong, and he even went and changed his password to make sure everything was synced up right. That didn't fix it, still telling him it was wrong. And thankfully, we'd heard from plenty of you about it, so I was able to help Gray with the solution that one of our other listeners found. And I wanted to share this with all of you. Text Expander is often, if not always, the culprit here. And the reason is, when you're in the term, normally if you get a password dialog up, Text Expander turns itself off so that it doesn't get in the way and automatically do some expansions while you are typing your password. In the terminal, Text Expander has currently, I don't know if it's possible for this to change, but currently it has no way of knowing that the terminal is asking you for your password, and therefore it does its expansions as though you were just typing. The problem is, A, you don't want it to do that, and B, because the terminal doesn't echo your characters back to you, you don't suddenly see that you've typed, 15 characters where you thought you typed two. And that is what was causing the problem. So the solution is to just temporarily disable Text Expander, and then it worked fine. So I figured I would share that tip with you so that if any of you run into that, you know exactly what to try, and hopefully it would work for you. And we will point, I think the folks at Smile know this, but we're going to point it out to them so that they at least are aware of it. I'm not sure there's any way for them to be able to sense that condition and disable themselves. But it could be that when you launch the terminal, Text Expander could pop up for the first time, at least when it goes to do an expansion at the terminal, and say, hey, here's this scenario. So, there's an idea for you folks at Smile. We'll share this segment with them. So. And then, John, you had a question.
Yeah, Dave, I was so excited. So they just came out with OS X update 10.9.1. Isn't that awesome?
It is.
And even awesomer is that it included an update to Mail App. Well, what I call Mail App, mail.app.
Yeah. Right.
Apple Mail. And that's great, because I think you and I both acknowledge that they kind of screwed some stuff up with Mavericks Mail.
Yeah.
Or the version of Mail that initially came out with Mavericks had some serious issues with, I think, mostly Gmail and some other issues. So they came out with the update, Dave, and I was so excited. So, of course, I applied the update and everything seemed cool. And then I launched Mail and I got this dreaded dialogue saying, some of your plugins aren't the essence of the dialogue. I don't have it in front of me, but the essence of the dialogue is, some of your plugins, they're not certified to run, or this new version of Mail does not acknowledge them. So, I'm going to disable them.
Right.
And I'm going to toss them in this folder for you, which actually where you're going to see this happen, I think, is, let's see, if you look in your home directory, library, mail, bundles, it'll put it in a disabled folder and you will lose the functionality. Now, in my case, Dave, I have two plugins that I run that were affected by this. One is Signature Profiler, which I love to death. And the other is Spam Sieve, which I still use because I like having secondary spam detection. Sure. And both of those got put in the disabled folder. A pain in the neck.
The problem
because
is
then
once the developer comes out with an update, because the plugin's not active, you don't get the auto update notification. So it's a spiral that never ends.
And right. So what normally happens is I had to wait for the developers, and they did not immediately, though within a day, both developers did release new versions that had, which I guess I'll call a signature, that was compatible with the new version of Mail, and everything was good. But I temporarily lost the functionality. And to me, that's bad.
So here's what's going on. Starting, I think, with Lion, Apple decided that they didn't want developers just releasing Mail plugins and then forgetting about those, and users trying to use them in future versions of Mail without the developer having said, yeah, I've tested this on my end and it works in this version of Mail. I guess Apple was seeing a lot of support calls saying, hey, Mail is crashy like crazy. And when they finally dug into the bundles, they realized, well, you're running this thing from like, you know, 3 years ago. Maybe that's the problem. It hasn't been updated. So to enforce this, what Apple did is they made it so that, as John said, every bundle that's installed inside Mail has to have a signature for it that matches the current version of Mail, which means if you update Mail before you update your plugins, even if the updates are out, they don't even have a chance to run and check for an update to themselves because Mail says, oh, my signature's not in there. It's out. Thankfully, there are ways of putting your putting the current version of Mail's signature into the plugin, and then Mail will run it. And you can do this from the terminal. It's sort of a convoluted process because you have to extract the signature ID from Mail and then put it into the right file. GPG tools, John, you'll notice that did not fail on you because they have a launch DP list that runs at every boot, and they call it a self-healing thing. All it does at every boot is it just adds the ID from Mail if it's not already in there. So it does this magic that would happen behind the scenes. It does it right then and there on boot up. So GPG tools is sort of protected from this as long as there's a reboot install as part of the process. Other Mail plugins don't do this. However, there's a great piece of software that I found a couple of months ago called Mail Plugin Fix from code2k.net. And we'll put a link in the show notes. And that goes through and takes all of your plugins. It shows you all of your plugins that you have that have been disabled. And it lets you say, yep, please re-enable these. I'm willing to live with the chances. I know the developer hasn't certified this yet, but I want to re-enable it. And it will go through and do that magic for you. So makes life way, way easier. So there you go.
Yeah.
Mail Plugin Fix.
Yep. Thank you, because that's always been an aggravation because, as you pointed out, there's a way where if you know the right formula, you can, through the terminal, come up with the signature or UUID, I think it is, or GUID or whatever.
Yeah.
Some code, but if it's not there, then Because actually what happened to my case is that actually because SpamSieve was disabled, it actually filtered all my mail into my spam folder.
Oh, right.
Until I re-enabled it because
that's right.
The problem is the rule was still there, but the plugin wasn't there.
Right.
And the rule says, hey, check all mail and, put it in the spam folder. So minor inconvenience, but
it's good stuff. No, I needed that mail plugin fix when I was running the betas of Mavericks because every beta version had a new build of mail and developers had to, and developers were pretty good. At least, Scott and Scott, which are the two that I use. I use Signature Profile from Scott Little and Mail Acton from Scott Morrison. And they were both pretty good about staying up to date on that stuff. But sometimes I would get the update before, out of sync. So that was I did it from the terminal far too often, but now I don't have to. So it's good. All right, John, let's move us on to Stephen, shall we?
I think it's Stefan.
It could be Stefan. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
S-T-E-P-H-A-N.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll try to condense it because I'll see what I can do because, I'm good at brevity.
Yes. Yes. John, you are known for your dulcet tones and your brevity.
Correct. All right. So Stefan writes, I have a question for my two favorite geeks and the only geeks I would trust with my Macs. And that's very sweet. A few days ago, I bought a new 27-inch iMac. I had originally purchased it with 8 gigs of RAM from Apple, but immediately removed the RAM and replaced it with 32 gigs, 4 8-gig chips from Crucial before I'd ever booted the machine. Upon starting up, the RAM was recognized immediately and the Mac has been running perfectly ever since. How is that a problem, you ask? Well, it isn't, but here's my question that I really love for you to weigh in on. And I'm sure many listeners have and will be in this situation. In your opinion, when doing a RAM replacement or upgrade, should I run a comprehensive RAM test in order to ascertain that the memory is working flawlessly? And I think maybe I'll condense it.
That's fine. Yeah.
Past that. And then I'll go to the final question. So there's some more stuff here and you may have something, and I'm almost certain you have something to add here, Dave.
I do.
But his questions are, do you recommend I run a number one, do you recommend I run a comprehensive RAM test? Number two, if so, what utility would you use and how to run the test so as to test as much of the RAM as possible? And three, do you think there's any concern with doing this? And here was my take on it, Dave. So I replied, personally, I don't see any need to do a comprehensive RAM test. Just make sure that you go with a vendor that understands Mac RAM and can provide you with the proper size and speed for your machine. Crucial, who he bought from, is someone I trust. OWC is another that I've used in the past, and I trust them. So I would say that just make sure you get a vendor that understands Macs and understands, you know, the right type of chip that you need. But the reason I say that I don't recommend it, Dave, is because the Mac already does this at a high level. And maybe you'll agree or disagree, but the Mac does actually two types of tests here. And they have, I love these things here at Dave. Apple has a wonderful support article telling you exactly what they do to test your RAM. And there are basically two things that will happen. So once, if you start up the machine, and actually, one of our listeners, Stacy, actually went through this. So she actually said, I got a new computer and I want to, and should I go to the Apple store to have them install it? And I'm like, no, because I actually sent her a link to, surprise, yet another Apple support article that tells you how, with her model iMac, how to replace the RAM. And she ran into some of the things that the Mac will do to tell you if you didn't get it quite right. So modern Macs will do two things. So, one, you will either get, as the article tells you, you will either get a combination of tones or blinking LEDs that happen after what's called the post or power on self test. And in my opinion, Dave, if your machine starts up and you do not either see blinking LEDs or hear tones, then I would be okay with the RAM that I just installed.
Huh.
Now, as a little sideline here, the thing is what Stacy ran into. So apparently this was the first time she did this. She actually ran into the situation where she installed the RAM, and I suspect that she probably didn't get it quite seated properly. And one of the things that'll happen is you will hear three beeps when your machine starts up, basically saying, something's not quite right here in the memory department. You may want to check it out. So that's my take, is that the Mac does a high level test. And if you don't hear beeps or blinking LEDs, you're good to go. But I would invite your take on this, my friend.
I agree with one of those two statements, that the Mac does a high level test. Absolutely. And no. Okay. And if there is an obvious problem with the RAM, like a chip is not seated and it can't even see all of the RAM, then it will tell you there's a problem. Your second statement of if you don't hear any beeps, then you are good to go, I completely disagree with. Because it's not true. And I don't say that to be overly aggressive. I say it from experience. No. The test that Apple does on boot is, as you said, very high level and not at all comprehensive. It does not try to read from every, you know, when we used to have those old IBM PCs, the XT or the AT, you'd actually see it count RAM when it started, and you could tell it to do the long test if you went into the BIOS, but it took forever. And that was on a machine with, like, you know, a meg of RAM or something, right? Now we have gigabytes of RAM. It would take a long time to test all of that comprehensively. And when I say comprehensively, I mean reading from or writing to RAM and then reading from it and making sure that it is addressable, changeable, and readable. So the systems don't do that when they start up. They don't go through every bit of RAM and check them.
And
I've seen this where, you know, a machine runs, it boots, and then weird things will happen and you can have a bad chip. RAM tests, it is especially when installing third-party RAM, I do highly recommend, maybe not the day you install it, because it takes a while. It sometimes will take hours to do a test of all of your memory, but it is a good way. Memory tends not to go bad for no good reason. So if the RAM is good the day you put it in, unless you have some sort of power spike, it's going to stay good. You know, there's no moving parts or anything to wear out. So what I do when I get a new Mac, even if it has Apple RAM or if I get, you know, third party RAM.
To me, I agree with you. A lot of hardware, including memory, DOA, you either get it where it's dead on arrival, which I think in the industry we refer to it. Yeah, it's DOA. The memory came, it's busted, and it's not working. But right. Go on. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. And you're right. So what I do, and I don't necessarily do it on day number one because it takes hours, but usually within the first week or two, I'll remember, oh, yeah, I got to do a memory test. And it's just a nice way to check your sanity 3 months down the road or 3 years down the road when the machine starts acting funky and you're like, well, is the RAM bad? You know, I don't know. I never tested it. Well, now I did, you know. So I used to use a piece of software called Memtest, and you'd do it from the command line. I would boot into single user mode and you could run Memtest from there. That I don't believe that works under Mavericks anymore. It used to be part of Applejack, but I don't even think Applejack runs under Mavericks now. But I haven't checked. I did, however, just find and I'm checking. I'm doing two things at once, which I shouldn't be doing. But I was checking to see if Applejack works under Mavericks. But so you'll check that, John. It's Applejack.sourceforge.net.
I was checking something else. But,
okay, so
which is relevant.
I did notice this week. I got an email from Micromat. They released Tech Tool Pro version 7, and it has a built-in memory test. So that might be reason enough to go check out Tech Tool Pro. So I don't have it yet. It's $100 for the full version. And I haven't tested it out, but having a memory test in there, it is, I just find it a nice thing to confirm my sanity, either at the very beginning, you know, just to get a baseline, but also when things start getting funky, it trying to deal with bad hardware, especially RAM, it can get funky. So it's nice to have something to just test it.
Well, I want to be clear here. When you say funky, which I know you're the funk master.
I am.
At least you're a musician, so you're funkier than I am.
That's right.
Do I play sax? Mm-hmm. you know, and I was looking this up, but I haven't looked into this in a while, Dave. Another thing is that there is something, and I still think it exists, though I haven't run it a long time, called Apple Hardware Test.
Yeah, that doesn't test the RAM well either. It does more of a test.
They have a short test. Yeah. So it does more than the power on self test, but it's not as comprehensive as some of these other tools, which I think totally go through all the memory and read and write and check things. But I'm thinking Apple Hardware Test, which I believe now, and I guess on the latest version of Macs, and I haven't run in a while, Dave, but my understanding, again, looking at the Apple Support article, they say that if you start up a recent Mac and you hold down D, it will run.
Yep.
Apple Hardware Test, then one of the tests is for memory. So, but I guess getting back to my original question is, when you say funky things happening, I would say a kernel panic is probably the funkiness you're talking about.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if you get a kernel panic, I mean, a lot of the things in a kernel panic screen are incomprehensible.
Yes.
But I would say if you get frequent kernel panics, it may be due to memory, in which case you may want to do a comprehensive memory test.
Yeah, kernel panics can also be just a bad driver running. I mean, it could be a lot of things. But if you're getting and this is true in general, I find when troubleshooting, if I can consistently reproduce the error, it's more often than not a software problem. And if I can't, if it's an inconsistent error, that more often than not is a hardware problem. There are exceptions to those rules, and I have lived exceptions on both sides, and it's normal. It's maybe, you know, 70% true, but that, there you go. So, yeah.
Right. And I think the final recommendation I made is make sure you get it. And I believe both of the vendors that I mentioned, you know, Crucial, OWC, any others that you prefer, Dave? Those are my favorites.
Yeah, those are the ones I trust these days. I don't know enough about the new owners over at Ramjet. I have not tested their RAM since the company was bought. It doesn't mean that it's bad or different. It may, in fact, be the same thing. I have not tested it since last year when Aaron sold it off. So,
Right. So make sure, and I think almost all of these guys offer a pretty decent, I'm not sure if it's lifetime, but a decent warranty. And if something's wrong, they'll
Ram doesn't come with a lifetime warranty, don't buy it. As we said, okay. Well, most vendors offer it because Ram doesn't go bad. So there you go.
Unless, the only situation I've seen it gone bad is either if you, you don't install it properly.
Sure.
And for goodness sake, if you're installing RAM, ground yourself in cases where I've seen RAM go bad, most of the time it's due to what I'll call operator error.
That's right. Yeah.
But once it's in there, you're good. Okay. All right, cool.
All right. Adam, take it away.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Adam. I would really appreciate it if you could help me out. My wife has asked me for Christmas to provide her a solution. It would be so much easier to buy her something, but instead I have to solve this problem that she's having with her MacBook Pro. She still has a 17-inch model for some reason. And the problem is that she has an RX 100 camera that I bought her last year for Christmas. And it's a 20-something megapixel camera, and it makes gigantic files. So every time it makes a file, we use iFi, or we're trying to use iFi, to get it to put pictures onto her computer. And the first problem is that the camera needs to be kept awake. The iFi doesn't want to connect. Sometimes the files don't show up. But if they do end up getting to her computer, they end up taking up a lot of space, especially the video files. In one case, I saw a video file almost 1 gigabyte in size. And so for a person that has, this is a 256 gigabyte computer, you can imagine it fills up the space rather quickly. Just to have a few videos, and she has Dropbox syncing files across devices. And that is one of our requirements for the solution, is to be able to access her pictures and videos on all our devices. And problem is that it's caused a seriously small amount of residual space on her computer to actually run the computer. So what we want is that what she wants is some way to be able to get these files somewhere that they can be accessed easily, but from all devices, and not have to worry about their size. At some point I thought maybe I'd put a time capsule on the network, but I'm not exactly sure how to do that with the iFi, and I'm not even sure the iFi is a good solution. I don't know if it's really that this camera is the problem. It just creates these really large files. The question is how to, what kind of a scheme, NAS drive or whatever, to set up with photos going essentially, I assume, to iPhoto, after they're automatically taken. So all we want is the camera to take a picture or videos, have them all centrally deposited, but not take up so much space that they're actually causing the computer to have a shorter space and have problems running, crashing, and so forth.
All right, we can take it there. He offered some suggestions as well. So this is an interesting question because it's a scenario that has a lot of moving parts, and if I boil it all down, it sounds like what he's looking for is a way to get pictures off the camera wirelessly to the computer, but not be permanently stored on the computer where they're always taking up space. So, and he did, he suggested NAS drives, in the portion of the question you didn't hear, he thought maybe the transporter would work. And I think, yeah, the transporter may be a great solution here what you would do is point the iFi destination at the transporter's library folder. Now your computer sees that, but the data isn't actually stored on your computer. It's just, mounted as a network drive in a sense, if you will. And that way the computer can see the stuff there. It can write to it. It can pass things from the camera to it. but you're not, you know, the data isn't taking up space on the computer. It's living on the transporter. With any solution like that, you've then got to be very aware of backing up, because the data is now only living in one place. So you've got to solve that problem of backing all that stuff up. But that could work. He mentioned automatic syncing to Dropbox. The transporter itself doesn't have a way to sync to Dropbox, but the transporter kind of has its own Dropbox thing involved. So, you know, its own personal cloud. So that may be enough. If you do need Dropbox support, then we start talking about a different type of NAS, the Synology Disk Stations. John, you and I found a third-party package called Synobox, which is effectively a Dropbox client for the Synology Disk Station, so it can sync itself to Dropbox. And so that's another option. And then Synology has their cloud station, so you may or may not need that there. It's an interesting scenario. You know, the other thing is, you could, depending on how you have iFi set up, what my wife does is she has a smaller hard drive on her computer, and she doesn't want to store all the pictures in one place or on the computer, but she does want them all in one library. And we actually have her connecting her iPhoto library lives on one of our Synology, I guess we only run one, on our Synology disk station here in the office. And she connects to that over the network, and her iPhoto library lives there. She mounts that over the network and reads and writes from it. And it's totally fine. Remember, you know, if you've got if your NAS can perform fast enough, and I've seen the Synology units regularly and totally soak up my gigabit Ethernet pipe. So there's, you know, plenty of bandwidth there and plenty of speed coming to and from the drives, that it's probably faster for her to write to that than to write to her local hard drive in her computer that's going to max out at, you know, maybe a third of that speed. So, you know, that part works fine. And so that's another option, is just don't even store your iPhoto library locally. Again, you know, backing up when you've got data only in one place, you've got to be aware of that. But those are some relatively straightforward, simple solutions, but it does require you getting some other hardware. John, I'm eager to hear what you have to say.
I got nothing. Oh, of course. I got plenty.
Good.
So one, unfortunately, Dave, you know, I do have an iFi card, but it went on the blink lately, and I got to revisit them, because it was the latest X2 card, wonderful card, and then all of a sudden my camera and my computer don't recognize it. I'm very sad. So
they do go bad. They do.
I don't know if I zapped it or it just failed or whatever, but I got to get back in touch with them. I think I pinged them once and nothing happened. So, hi iFi. Hi guys. Because I love it. I mean, it's very convenient, but here are a couple of suggestions.
They do burn batteries, though. I highly recommend using an iFi card if you are not using the wireless portion of it, because after each picture, it gets very it gets very battery use. Okay.
Well, actually, in that vein, Dave, the thing is, for every digital camera I've had, I don't get I have not one, not two, believe it or not, three batteries.
Yeah.
So like the Lumix, which is my primary camera, I have three batteries.
Yep.
So for any of you digital photo hounds, yeah. I mean, don't just have one battery. Come on, man.
Right.
Because it just won't last. So a couple of suggestions. Number one, I believe the camera mentioned was the RX100.
Correct. The Sony. That's right.
Okay. One thing I looked at here, which you may want to consider, this shoots in both JPEG and RAW. RAW takes up lots of space. And last I recall, the iFi will give you a choice whether you want to transfer RAW or not. Mm. Consider whether you really need RAW. For me,
I think his problem was the videos, which are compressed.
I understand. Yeah. I'm just offering suggestions, is that if you don't need RAW photos, then don't transfer them.
Yep.
I personally have not use the camera that does RAW, and I've been okay with JPEG. So number one, but number two, I think to me, it's almost the simple solution is last I checked. I mean, when the iFi uploads, it'll upload to any folder or attached drive. So one thing you may want to consider is to have the iFi pointing to a large external USB drive, which I think you kind of suggested, Dave, with a NAS drive. I'm going to say a USB drive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you may want to consider that. So consider tossing everything on an external drive, because the good news there is you can also, of course, put your iPhoto library or Aperture library on an external drive.
Yep.
But he said he's using iPhoto.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I would do, my technique would be to do a multi-stage approach. So what I would do is when I had the iFi is I would have it transfer to a large or to a folder on my local hard drive, and then I would then drag it into, and I believe it's the same for iPhoto or Aperture, is when you drag a group of photos from a folder onto the program, by default, I believe it creates a new, whether it be an album or a project. So if you're okay with staging your workflow like that, or maybe even creating, and I think I did this as well, is I think I even created a small automator script that would actually take the photos that I dragged onto it, and the ones that I dragged onto there, if you want to get some level of granularity, would create a new project for every group of photos that you brought over. So,
Yeah.
So I think that's what I got there. So yeah. I think, you know, and this is the hesitation that I have, Dave, personally, with getting a machine with a very small local hard drive is exactly this reason. Like right now I have, as you know, and it's funny because actually other people have come up with this. I think we may have chatted about this, but right now I have the 750 gig Momentous XT from Seagate. And I've seen that actually, I believe Toshiba has also come out with a hybrid hard drive. I think right now I think I saw OWC had one, a Toshiba hybrid 1 terabyte hard drive for only a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah. I disagree with that. I think, there will always be.
Of course you do.
Well, no, I know. But I've gone in a different direction with it. And this started years ago for me with my music collection.
No, I get it. I know you. I'm just. My worry is that for exactly this reason, I'm hesitant to get a machine with a very small local hard drive.
Right, but let me tell you why that doesn't matter.
Go.
Right. So yeah, I did this years ago. I couldn't fit my music library on my. On my local hard drive anymore. Mm-hmm. And this was back when I was using a laptop as my main machine, and I just had to get used to it. And for years, I actually carried around an external USB drive with my music library on it because that's the only way I could do it. And then finally it was like, no, this is stupid. And so I put it off. I think at the time it was my Drobo FS because that was the only NAS unit I had. And as soon as I did that, it was so liberating. It's like, oh, this I'm being stupid about having all this space in one spot. I don't need that. I just need space, but it doesn't have to be in one spot. And by freeing myself of the requirement that it be in the one computer, I now have the access to, you know, virtually unlimited space. With either, you know, a direct attached Drobo or a NAS drive or whatever. And then, of course, it got even better because I had already decentralized myself and put my photos and my music and my movies on a NAS drive. When I moved to Synology a couple of years ago and they had things like Audio Station and Photo Station and Video Station and Plex, it was easy for me because I just said, oh, well, my stuff's already on here. Point these, you know, apps at it. And now, you know, with Audio Station, I can get my music wherever I am. It doesn't matter. It's like I've rolled my own iTunes match and the same with photos and all that stuff. So I think detaching from trying to cram it all into your hard drive, the issue mm-hmm. is you will run into with one drive, you will run into a scenario where you can't store everything you want. So it's better to just assume you're not going to be able to. My feeling is it's better to just assume you're not going to be able to do that and put it off on something that's going to be vastly larger and expandable, as opposed to trying to, you know, say, because like you, right, you now have painted yourself into a situation where you can't reasonably afford to run on an SSD on your main machine because you have this requirement that you need, you know, nearly a terabyte of storage to be able to store all this stuff locally. But if you detached from that and just put your photos on the disk station, which would run just fine for you, then you could have a 256 gig SSD in there, and you'd, your whole computing experience would be faster. So
don't tell me what to do.
I'm just saying that you've painted yourself into a corner.
I'm balancing performance with a hybrid drive with storage space.
I know. And that's it. You've had to compromise because
yes, I understand. Yeah. No, I get it. And I'm good with the compromise.
Yeah. Until you test it the other way. Until you've perhaps seen the light. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. At some point I'll admit you're right.
I know. Yeah. No, it's true. I beat on you with this stuff long enough. And then someday you're like, oh, actually, I ordered it this way and I'm just going to do this because it's so much better. I'm like, OK, good. Whew. Excellent. So we all learn along the way.
But I like the hybrid drives.
I know.
I think they're a good compromise.
Yeah. I don't feel the need for compromise in my life. Why bother? Well, because
if I could get a terabyte SSD for $100, I'd do it in
but you don't need a terabyte SSD. You need a couple hundred gigs SSD for your apps.
No, I know you're saying.
And then, you know,
I should rethink my storage strategy, which is what we're
discussing
here.
That's right. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, someday I'll change.
It's good. It makes for a good show. I mean, look, we've been doing this 8.5 years, so I'm good. I'm happy.
Yeah, I'll admit you're right every now and then.
And vice versa, my friend. All right. Robert writes, a quick one.
Again?
Yeah, it might even be the same Robert. He says...
it is the same Robert.
Okay. He says...
Hi, Robert.
I love this live track that I found on YouTube, but I can't find it for purchase anywhere. What is the best way for me to save the audio track into iTunes? Okay. So this is an interesting question because it comes with a couple of different answers.
I think I did mention it in the last show, but we're going to do a fuller exploration of this.
Okay.
Robert.
Well, we can probably be done with this in about 3 minutes or less. There's two pieces of software that I would go to for something like this. Number one is from, at MacXDVD.com, they have a piece of software called YouTube Video Downloader for Mac, and it's free from DigiArty Software. It's MacX. And I've used this, and it's awesome. You take the YouTube URL, you paste it in, and they go and it shows you all the different formats that YouTube has and different sizes. And you say, I want to download this one, and it downloads it, and it will even convert it into, you know, an MP4 file for you. That's for video. I believe there's a way to tell it to extract the audio and do things with the audio. But that's one way of doing that. So that's one piece of software, and we'll put that in the show notes. It's something I keep around, and, cause there's some videos that are out there on YouTube that people have put up that are, you know, there's some of this old Steve Jobs footage and stuff that I just want to have. And so I download it. You can yell at me if you want, but, if I could buy it, I would, but it's a lot of this stuff you just can't, you know. So the other way to do just the audio, which is what Robert's initial question was, is to use something like Audio Hijack Pro. Audio Hijack Pro will let you capture audio in real time. In fact, we use it right now to record this show. And then you can save the audio. And again, you can save it in a compressed format or an uncompressed format, whatever you want. So you would install Audio Hijack Pro. You'd point it at Safari. You would say record Safari, and then you'd play the video. And of course the audio comes out. Audio Hijack Pro takes the audio that Safari played, saves it to a file, and you're done. So either one of those would solve that problem in slightly different ways. The YouTube downloader one does it digitally and just downloads it. Audio Hijack Pro also does it digitally, but it does it in real time. So you have to play the song in this case in its entirety.
And Dave, I'm sad because number one, this came in the chat room here, which if you're not aware of our chat room, I believe it's at macgeekapp.com/stream.
Yes, sir.
Or if during the show, if you'd like to hear us or interact in our IRC chat room, which is just a crazy place. But one of the folks in the chat room just said, hey, piezo. And this is actually something that I glossed on in a recent show.
Yep.
Unfortunately, piezo does not seem to be able to capture audio from Mavericks at this point with Safari.
Incorrect.
Sad.
Piezo now has initial compatibility with macOS 10 Mavericks as of recently, I believe.
Really? Because I just downloaded the latest update on my MacBook. Okay. I understand. I know they said, okay, maybe I have to get a newer update because I think like 2 days ago, I ran it on my MacBook Pro with Mavericks and it said, oh, there's a newer version. And I'm like, oh, well, let me try the audio capture. And it still said it didn't work. But
you're right. According to rogueamoeba.com/status, piezo, due to changes made by Apple, piezo can no longer capture audio from Safari. So there you go.
I'm right. Wow. Okay, yep. But I know they're working on it. They're trying to figure it out. They're a clever bunch. They're, they're audio wizards, but
they do have a solution. If you want to capture audio, use piezo and capture it from Chrome or Firefox.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. So the thing. Yeah, and I think the dialogue comes up. It's like, you know, sorry, dude, Safari's kind of messed up. So.
Yep. Yep.
And the other thing I want to toss in here, Dave, is as far as capturing YouTube videos.
Yes.
Here's another product. That I found, Dave, and it's called YouTube 5. And this is actually a Safari extension, which is very nice. And it does a whole bunch of things. But one thing that it does is when you're in YouTube, you can click within the player window. So it replaces your player with their player with some tweaks. But one thing is you can click and actually choose typically a number of formats that you want to save it in, whether it be Flash or I think even MP4. I don't know if you use this one. I've used this for quite a while here, and it not only works with YouTube, but I think Vimeo, Facebook, and things like that. But it offers a whole bunch of features versus the default Flash player.
Yeah, right. So the main purpose of YouTube 5 is to play video to not use the Flash player and to use the HTML5 player, hence the name YouTube 5 extension. It will do these other things. However, over the last couple of years, we've heard a lot from a lot of listeners that have had weird problems with Safari and videos. And in most of those cases, it's turned out that they have this YouTube 5 extension installed unbeknownst to them. And removing it solves those problems. So I'm not saying that it causes problems for everyone in every circumstance, but if you do choose to install this, remember that you've done that. And then, you know, if you do run into problems, you know, turn that extension off and see if that solves
even better
it for you.
When the player comes up, it actually has a link saying revert to original player.
Right. No, so but having the plugin enabled has caused people problems. It's
right.
Not even the player.
Okay.
The reverting doesn't fix it in the situations that we've seen.
Okay.
Now, that could have been older versions of the extension, but I'm just putting it out there because people have a habit of installing, like we were talking about with Mail earlier, right? People have a habit of installing extensions into Safari and then forgetting about them. And unlike Mail, Safari doesn't deprecate the extension if it has not been updated for the current flavor of Safari. So, all right. Where are we on time here? Because I want to make sure we get through some of this
53.
Stuff. 53. All right. Do you want to do this thing about your updater or you want to skip that? Because if you want to do it, go.
Which one?
All right, so we will move on, I guess, to the cool stuff found, right? Okay.
Oh, no, okay. No, very quickly.
Yeah, go.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you're upgrading to Google Drive, so I had this happen. Well, we'll link to the article, but basically, this is another OS-related issue. So once I upgraded to 10.9.1, Google came up, and Google has this kind of sneaky upgrade process, and it said, hey, you want to upgrade Google Drive? And I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem. And it got stuck. Basically, I had Google Drive in my menu, and it said, click here to update. And I clicked on it, and nothing happened. So basically, what we'll link to is a support article on the Google Forums that basically tells you how to do terminal magic to complete the upgrade to the Google Drive app if you choose to run that.
Oh,
it just
cool.
aggravated me because, yeah, again, it just came up and it said Google Drive. Click here to complete the update. And I clicked there and nothing happened. I'm like,
nice. Nice.
So these updates, you know, and it's just a general observation here, Dave. I think we just have here is these OS updates. I mean, I don't know if they're catching developers by surprise or what. I mean, I thought if you're part of the dev program or something, you would kind of anticipate these things. But having these things come up between mail plugins and stuff like that kind of surprises me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, Apple communicates with developers sometimes. Right. I mean, no, that's
well, I mean,
true.
I thought 10.9.1 was kind of a known phenomenon.
Oh, no, that, no, no, you know, no.
It's going to happen.
Don't blame the developers here, because every beta of 10.9.1 had individual mail build IDs. And then the final release of it had a different build ID. And the developers found out about that the same time you and I did. There's no warning that they get. So, yeah, those guys kept up to
shame on Apple.
Yeah, those guys kept up to date with it for every one of the betas of 10.9.1 because I was running them. And then 10.9.1 came out and it's yet a new ID.
Oh, well, I feel bad for the devs then. Mm-hmm. Well, hats off to the devs because, like I mentioned to you, the two mail updates within a day.
Yeah.
They had the updates.
Yeah. Well, it's a trivial thing for them to make the update to that plist
right.
file. Yeah. I mean, again, you can do it yourself. And that's what that app that we talked about earlier will do. All right. So we've got some cool things here. It being the holiday season. So you may hear this if you celebrate Christmas, you may hear this before Christmas. You may hear this after. So you might either be buying a last minute stocking stuffer or you might be treating yourself to something with one of those gift cards that you got for Christmas. So we've got some ideas for you. Daniel wrote and said, I found this thing called the Wally Stick-On and I've ordered one, but it's not arrived yet. So I figured I would share. And it's from distillunion.com. It's a pretty cool looking thing if you're willing to stick something to the back of your iPhone. But, you know, we've talked about wallets and having, you know, some credit cards on your iPhone. And this Wally thing does that. But without putting a case around your iPhone, it's a leather backing that you stick onto the back of your phone and it holds your credit cards and all that stuff. It looks pretty slick and yet doesn't, you know, encase your phone in a case if you're not into that. So we put that out there. That's the Wally Stick-On. All right. Something I found, John, and I'm going to grab the box so that I'm sure that I have all the right details.
Where are you going, man?
I'm back.
Where are you?
I am not a fan of condenser microphones for podcasting. Without being able to control, especially USB condenser microphones, because without being able to control the gain on them very closely, they tend to pick up a lot of room noise and be very bouncy and not very good. But you know, there are some, the Blue Yeti, was one that it has a gain control on it. So that made it totally usable. And when I travel, that's the mic that I've used. I got another microphone from Blue recently called the Nessie, N-E-S-S-I-E. They were showing it off, a prototype of it at CES last year, so you may have seen pictures of this thing. It kind of looks like the Loch Ness Monster, at least the Loch Ness Monster's head, hence the name Nessie. And it does not have gain control on it. So at first I was like, am I wasting my time plugging this thing in? Since I'm talking to you about it, you know the answer to that. No, I wasn't wasting my time. I was pleasantly surprised. Although I hate to be pleasantly surprised by condenser microphones in this sense, because I just have a natural aversion to them for podcasting and for Skype and that sort of thing. But this one proves me wrong. It's the exception to the rule. So what they've done, though, is very interesting. They have three settings on this mic. It's $100. It obviously has its own stand built in. It has a little mute switch built in. It also has audio out, so you can plug your headphones into this, and it's got this cool volume knob that's part of the bass, and so you can hear yourself and the other party if you want to do things that way. But What they've done is they've got three settings on this. One is what they call a flat setting, where it's just raw microphone. And in that, when you have it in flat, it acts just like a USB condenser mic that has no gain control does. And it picks up a lot of room noise and it's very bouncy and all of that stuff. When you put it into vocal mode, though, it's not just a gain reduction. There is processing going on inside this thing, and it clearly is adding some compression to the signal. It feels like to me that it's doing automatic gain control. So it's constantly adjusting the gain based on you talking into it. And even if I have the mic a few feet away from me, people that I'm talking to on Skype, I wouldn't do that for this podcast. I would have it much closer, like I do with the PR40 I'm on. But it sounds really good, and it doesn't get all bouncy, and yet it still has kind of a warm tone and all that. And then they have a third mode that is the instrument mode, and that's built for higher sound pressure levels and things like that. So definitely worth checking out if you are a microphone geek, or even if you just want, you know, I mean, it's $100, so it's not an impulse buy for most of us. But if you want a good mic to do Skype from your desk with, this is not a bad one to consider. And it is $100. So that's the Nessie. So I throw that out there. John, I really want to talk about this next one. You know, we talked about that brick phone a couple weeks ago, right?
And then I talked about the banana phone.
And then you talked to me, right?
Is the largest iPhone case in history.
That's right.
I think was the claim to fame.
That's right. Yes.
If you know somebody with these, you are privileged, because I mean, to me, it's just, and then there's a banana phone song. But anyway, go.
So in that same vein, is the Bluetooth gloves. Now, when Louis wrote in and told us about these, I was like, Bluetooth gloves, banana
Why
phone.
Would you need,
what are you talking about? And then I looked at the picture, and there's a dude. And you got to see this picture. I'll put it in the chat room. Obviously, we'll put the link in the show notes. But there's this dude that has his thumb in his ear and his pinky out by his mouth, making the hand gesture that we all make to simulate being on the phone. And that's the phone. So they are. It is gloves that are a Bluetooth handset.
Oh, no.
I know. And it's $30. So, you know, I mean, come on, you know. And after December, so by the time you hear this, it might be $50. They might go up 20, but I just couldn't, you know.
I although I'm a peaceful man, I'd almost be prone to violence if I saw somebody.
It's pretty, that. I know, but it's pretty freaking awesome if you ask me.
It's fun.
So we had to share that. Another piece of software that.
Oh, I got. Oh, all right, go ahead.
You got some? Well, that's right. You see, you snuck it into the agenda, so I didn't know to move it up. You put it in the list of that where I asked you if you wanted to do them. So let me do this one and then take yours.
Yeah.
So Dominic Fiera, who worked at Ambrosia Software, where Hector, our bird, worked for many years, he was one
worked
of.
Worked or. Ruled.
She ruled
with an iron
with her iron beak. That's right. So Dominic was one of the lead engineers on Wiretap Studio over there, and he has gone off on his own and has a company called Static Z Software, and their first product is out. It is called Sound Siphon, and it is a way to make your sounds audio out your Mac's audio output. Treated as an audio input. So very handy, for example, to solve Robert's problem earlier in the show, right? He's got audio coming out of his Mac with this song, but he can't record that. But he could record with QuickTime, even just with QuickTime Player, he could record audio coming in from his microphone. Well, Sound Siphon takes the audio coming out of his Mac and treats it like audio coming into his Mac. So you could point QuickTime at the Sound Siphon input and record it just like it's a microphone, even though it's your Mac's audio kind of looping back in on itself. So hopefully that explains what it is. And there's a little demo you can download, and it can do per app capture in Mavericks and all of that. So he could point it at just one app and pull that down. So good on you, Dominic. It's great that you're out there doing that, and I'm totally stoked to see it happen. So there you go. That's Sound Siphon. John, what do you got? Mm-hmm.
Dave, I have both a cool stuff found, at least in my humble opinion, mm-hmm. and a tip. So the cool stuff found. So I was getting kind of tired. So my network here, Dave, my Wi-Fi network is almost exclusively 802.11 end devices, except for this one problem child, and that's my 802.11g TO adapter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? And I was actually researching another TiVo question for a listener. And so I went to their store and I stumbled across this, Dave. And it surprised me because I did not know that this existed. And TiVo actually has, and it'll work on. So both you and I, Dave, I think we both have the rather dated, but still highly functional, in my opinion. Maybe not all the latest features, TiVo Series 3, which was the first release that would support HD video.
I do still have one of those. I also have a Premiere. The Premiere is in the living room.
Oh, you do? Okay. Oh, yeah, and dude, I think this device.
It's nice having the Premiere with all the extra fee. And now the Premiere is one model old, but being able to totally control it with the iPhone app and all of that, it's cool.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now they got the Romeo and you know, the Juliet will be coming at some point. But anyways, so Dave, I was looking for a way. Can I, you know, up my game here with my TiVo Series 3, because I got the G, and the thing is, as you may know, is, you know, if you have a Wi-Fi network, supporting older protocols may reduce your total system performance. I think that's a safe thing to say, correct? Uh-huh.
It may. That's right. Yeah. It reduces the size of the packets, I think, is part of what goes on.
Yeah. So optimally, if you can get everybody on the same protocol, in this case, in my household, it's 802.11n, yep. That's a good thing. And the TiVo adapter was the only thing. Well, I found this, Dave. They offered this at TiVo. I went in the TiVo store and I saw this thing called a TiVo factory renewed 802.11n adapter. And I'm like, well, that's for me. And so the thing is, Dave, it only costs $60. Oh, you know, versus the you know, price of the new one. But it's kind of funky. But the thing is, it leads to a tip, which is why I want to mention it, Dave. So number one, if you know somebody, and I'll have to find the support article because I think the TiVo Series 3 and even prior ones can support this. The thing is, you know, if you look at the throughput, 802.11g is 54 megabits, right? 802.11n is at least potentially twice as fast.
It's at least 150, if not 300 correct. Or 450. That's right. Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, well, you know, let me go for it. But the thing is, it's different. So whereas the 802g adapter plugged into the USB port on the TiVo, this plugged into the Ethernet port. So number one, kind of a finger wag at them. They show you a picture of this adapter. The thing is, what they don't show you is that it comes with this wacky adapter cable where you got to plug in power and blah, blah, and it plugs into the Ethernet port on the TiVo. And I'm like, okay, well, that's cool. The thing is, number one, it definitely improved the throughput. So I use some of the TiVo utilities, like I think iTiVo, to transfer video from my computer to the TiVo. And before, with the 802G adapter, it would actually get to a point where it would block. It would overload it in that it couldn't get the video. The thing is that the TiVo was not able to consume the data fast enough. Right?
Right.
Whereas with the N1, now because I'm getting speeds two times faster, I can actually transfer HD video over to the TiVo and I don't get the problem with it, buffering.
Yeah.
Huh. So I'm pretty groovy with that. But then number two, so I was yakking about this, and then our good friend, Brian Monroe, mm-hmm. he was like, well, that's interesting. Now, the thing is that when you think about this, Dave, so the way you configure it is you actually plug it into your computer first via Ethernet, via this wacky adapter, and you configure it as an access point. Mm-hmm. It has an IP address. You know what, Dave? This is actually a little baby.
It's a bridge.
Exactly. And that is what our friend Brian pointed out to me. He's like, is this a bridge? Now, the thing is, oddly enough, this thing has a switch on the bottom saying bridge or client, and I'd say client mode because you can actually relay these things.
Right,
you can
right.
actually get two of them. But the point that Brian brought up to me, and thank you very much, Brian, is that he said he's actually done this. So right now, when I go to the TiVo, when I say, tell me about my network connection, it doesn't show me a USB adapter with signal strength and all that. It says, I'm connected to Ethernet.
Right, because your TiVo is connected to Ethernet.
Because what Brian brought up, here's a little trick Brian brought up, and he said he's done this. You could also do this with something like an Airport Express.
Sure.
Nothing is in this case. This is $60, so it's less expensive, and it does exactly what I want, so I'm happy with it. But he suggested that if you took an airport and put it in bridge mode, in an expensive airport, like an Airport Express, you could accomplish the same thing with the TiVo and perhaps other DVRs that use Ethernet to connect to the world.
You could buy a $50 D-Link router and install DDWRT on it and do the same thing.
Right. So I thought that was a wonderful tip. So even though this, again, does what I need, putting a Wi-Fi access point in bridge mode and connecting it to at least my model of TiVo and yours and perhaps other DVRs.
Not my particular Series 3. I have...
Yeah, you told me you had issues.
Its Ethernet port works, but there's something wrong with it. It won't... Other devices on the network won't see it unless it has connected to them in the last, 5 minutes. I think there's... It's got to be that... Well, it's either that it needs like a firmware update, which is to say that it needs to be wiped out and restarted, or that somewhere along the line over the years, I got a power spike that fried some level of the Ethernet controller. Those are the only things that come to mind, because I tried it with Powerline down in our playroom and I had this problem, and I thought, well, maybe it's something to do with Powerline down there. It could be. And then I ran an Ethernet cable to the same switch that our other TiVo was in, and it did the same thing. So I was like, oh, okay, that's not Powerline's fault. So yeah, it sucks. I have to use the G adapter with our TiVo. But I've never had problems streaming HD to it. But it could be that I'm much closer to our access point than your TiVo is to yours, and you know what I mean? So it may.
So I guess what I'm saying, so the tip is, in general, and we've talked about it before, but, mention it again. Any sort of Wi-Fi access point in bridge mode could, act, in this case, it's doing exactly that. It's basically acting as a virtual, not Ethernet speeds, but it's acting similar to Powerline as a virtual network connection.
Yeah.
Virtual cable.
Yeah, actually.
I'm very happy with that. So I'm happy with the TiVo device. Again, finger wag, because they don't show you all the... it's a power supply and a wacky cable and the device itself.
Right.
But they only show the device itself.
Right. Of course. Of course.
Because I get it. And I'm like, what's all this other extra stuff?
All right, quick ones from, I believe, two different Scotts. Number one, first Scott, a couple of months ago, we mentioned that he was on a quest for finding the way to have Safari zoom in by site. He wants certain websites to be zoomed in and others to be at Safari's default zoom. And we weren't able to help him. He was able to help himself. He found a Safari extension called Safari Zoom by Sight, and it does exactly what he was looking for. And he says it's been working great. So we will throw that one into the show notes. And if you want that functionality, then go download it. I think it's free. I will check that right now just to make sure, because I like to be sure about that. Yeah. Yeah, it looks to be free. Perhaps shareware. It's hard to say. I think it's just free. So that's one from Scott. And then the other Scott, and I believe, yes, it is a different Scott. He says, we just had our yearly holiday party. We played the same music throughout the house. We do not have Sonos, though I will be looking at that when I move back to the USA. But I did the next best thing. He says, I installed Airfoil from Rogue Amoeba on my Mac and their speakers app on every iPod Touch we have. He says they're second-gen devices running iOS 5. I then took each iPod and connected them to speakers in various rooms via the headphone jack. Now I simply played my Christmas playlist from my Mac. The result was the same music everywhere in the house at the same time. Since I know it's not as simple as Sonos, but it is a lot cheaper. And I did it with spare stuff around the house. And that totally will work. I love it. I think it's awesome. We had a similar setup here for a while before we got Sonos. And it works. It's like you said, it's functional. It's not as elegant. And I'm curious to check out, you know, Sonos has been around for a while. And I've always complained that no one is truly competing with them. Bose and Samsung now have products that begin to approximate that. So I'm going to be checking those out and I'll let you know what.
That is awesome because I find this time of year, I have great difficulty in finding places I can go to that are not playing Christmas music.
I know, John. It'll be over soon.
I'm kidding.
For you.
I'm kidding. Bah humbug, get off my lawn.
Get off. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, every time I go to the grocery store, it's a constant reel of. I like a little variety in my life. I understand it's the holidays and Christmas and all that great stuff.
I have found that Pandora.
A little rock and roll track every now and then. Well, or maybe rock and roll Christmas music. There we go.
That's what I was going to say.
Instead of cheesy remakes or, cheesy.
We use Pandora.
I want variety.
Pandora's Rockin' Holidays or Rockin' Holiday Mix
really?
Or something.
Okay.
It's awesome. And
go.
Of course, Pandora links with Sonos. So with a sweet. Flip of a button, we have Rockin' Holidays throughout the house. And it actually works great.
I need Rockin' Holidays.
Yeah,
okay,
you do.
I'll fire my Pandora.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is on my TiVo. Pandora on my TiVo. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it.
That's awesome. All right, well, we are wrapping this up, so we will have one more podcast before the end of the year. We're doing one again next weekend. And, John, I was thinking, I hadn't shared this with you, but what I'm going to do this week is I'm going to go back through and look at I'm probably not going to listen to every episode because I don't think I have 50, 60 hours to do that. But I am going to look back at all of our show notes and stuff from the last year and sort of remind myself of what we've been through over the last year. And maybe we'll have we won't spend the whole episode reminiscing, but we'll have a bit of a retrospective portion of it. Speaking of reminiscing, though, I want to tell you about something. Yes. January 24th of of next year, 2014, will be 30 years since the Macintosh was introduced. And I've been very excited about this and haven't been able to say anything until, well, yesterday. But they are doing Gabriel Franklin, who's a filmmaker, in conjunction with the Computer History Museum and Macworld iWorld, is putting on a celebration in Cupertino at the Flint Center, where I believe it was where the first Mac was introduced. And they're going to have members of the original Mac team speak. They say there's going to be special guests there between us. I think that includes Waz is going to be there. Ridley Scott's going to be there to talk about the ad. Dan Kotke's going to be there, Steve's old roommate. And Dan's a great guy. He's the one that went to India with Steve and all that stuff. But and then for me, the sort of the linchpin is that the whole thing is going to be capped off by a musical performance by the Macworld All-Star Band. We've been invited to play, so I'll be going out there for that. And that's January 25th in Cupertino. And we'll put a link in the show notes about the how you can get tickets and all of that good stuff. So that's I'm excited about this, John. This is good, right? No?
I'd be.
No, I think so.
The Macworld All-Star Band.
I know.
Company? Outstanding.
Isn't that awesome? I was really stoked.
Maybe I can fly out or drive out or train out or something.
You could fly out. We might be able to get you a ticket. So.
Ooh. Oh, okay. Yeah. Tempting.
We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Elise is going. But Elise is coming with me for this one. So she's finally going to get to see the band play.
She's never seen the Macworld All-Star.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, she's seen us on video, but she's never been in the room. Yeah. So now she gets to come to where we're playing at the Flint Center, which is like, you know, it's a 2,000 seater or something. Just, you know, hey, that's pretty good. I know. Yeah. So there you go. So I'm excited about that. So that link will be in the show notes. What? I need to sign in. What's going on, Google? Okay.
You've got some major, I don't know, folks, behind the scenes, today was just a cascade of bad fortune.
But I'll say.
You don't know that because
we aim to please here.
Well, and I offered some sage advice to my esteemed colleague here, and he fixed it.
No, you know what? That's actually a good little tip to throw in. That one last pre-Christmas tip. We were having a problem. I updated Audio Hijack Pro and Nicecast this week, which I use, as I mentioned, to record the show, and the Nicecast to stream it. And I tested it to make sure that it launched, and I tested it to make sure that I could capture my own audio here. And I'm like, okay, great, we're great. So then I went through, and when John and I synced up earlier tonight, I did all my things, and John's audio sounded weird, and I realized it wasn't capturing Skype for me. And I have things set up in a weird way, so this may or may not happen for you if you try it with the latest version, but it wouldn't work at all for me. And I was like, dang it. And I'm like, I don't know if we could do the show. And John said, and I'm trying to solve it and trying to solve it with the existing version. And John said, well, I assume you've thought about rolling back to a previous version, which I had not yet.
That worked.
Well, yeah, right. Roll back to what works. And you know, as geeks, we always like to move forward and, you know, solve problems. But when it's showtime and the show must go on, well, sometimes what you got to do is go with what works, which is why this machine doesn't have Mavericks on it yet. I mean, there's, you know, I'm pretty careful about this, but I've never had a problem with an AHP update, but they changed some fundamental things. So I sent them a note. Well, it'll be fine. But yeah, that's great advice. And Time Machine came to the rescue. I just, you know, went into Time Machine, grabbed the old version, brought it out, and golden. So thanks, John. Yeah, you saved all of our bacon today.
Well, if anything,
you saved Christmas.
To me, well, I don't know about that. But no, I've seen this, and I would almost hint, Dave, that being a software type of guy, this is the importance of what I'll call version control.
Yep.
So when you have something that works, you take a snapshot, and you're good. And then if somewhere down the line something is not working, you always have a way, if you use version control, whether it be Git or Subversion or whatever, or Time Machine, then you can go back to a prior version that you know worked.
Absolutely. So, all right. If you have a tip, if you have a question, or if you just want to wish us Merry Christmas, feedback@macgeekup.com is the email address to use.
And I believe I heard you, Dave. Now, you could also wish us Merry or Happy Hanukkah, or...
Well, it's over.
Hanukkah's Festivus.
Over. Festivus is tomorrow. That's right.
Yeah. Festivus. So if you want to wish us a Merry Festivus, you could also send us an email at feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's right. And if you want to, you know, depending on when you're listening to this, if you want to wish us a Happy New Year, you could do that to feedback@macgeekab.com as well. And of course, if you are a premium member, you get to use premium@macgeekab.com. You can learn all about how to become a premium member at macgeekab.com on the web. What else? You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
4335. Now, the thing is, email takes a while, and we do have a big stack of email to go through. So if you want immediate satisfaction, there's the Twitters, which Dave and I and, well, everybody is almost always paying attention to. But if you're on the Twitters, the podcast is Mac Geekab. I am John F. Ron. He is Dave Hamilton. The publication is Mac Observer, all on Twitter.com. But there's more.
There is more. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/MacGeekGab. I don't know. Where else can they find us? I think that's it, right, John? We've been rambling for a while. This is the longest end of a show we've had in a long time.
Well, to wrap it up, Dave, you know, if you want to give us a gift, hopefully it's a gift. iTunes has a comments section. If you go to iTunes and you look up MacGeekGab, you can enter a comment
That would be an excellent Christmas gift for us. If you haven't left us an iTunes comment yet, yeah, that would be awesome. What an awesome thing. Yeah,
because when you really comment, help. It helps us. Yeah. It helps us do a better job. It helps expose the podcast and grow the Mac Geek Gab community, which I think is a good thing because we not only help you, but you and the community help us.
Yes.
And we thank you for it.
All right. So I want to thank Michael Johnston, and I'll wish Michael Johnston a Merry Christmas as well. Michael converts the show to AAC and adds all those chapters for us and for you. Michael is also the host of We Have Communicators and the publisher of GetAppler.com. So check both of those things out. I think you'll, if you like this podcast and you have an iOS device, I think you're going to love We Have Communicators as well. So I also thank Cashfly for all the bandwidth that gets the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes BB Edit from Barebone Software, a software, of course. It includes Text Expander and PDF Pen from Smile, Gazelle.com for selling all your stuff, Squarespace, as we mentioned, MGG12, and a special coupon code at Connect to Data. Go to filetransporter.com, use MGG30, and you get a $30 discount on a 1 terabyte transporter, but you got to do it before 12/31. So check all that out. If you celebrate Christmas, have a very Merry Christmas. If you don't celebrate Christmas, have an awesome Wednesday. And we'll see on the flip side for our final show of the year. John, lasting advice for anyone here?
As always, don't get caught.
Made up.
Hey, John, Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year.